From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know that I love to talk about the saints. And today is going to be no different. We're going to be talking about one of the great saints in the history of the Catholic Church. It's right around his death anniversary. We're talking about St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, the great philosopher that we have. He had some visions that gave him insight into his writings. But today we're going to be focusing on what he has to say about friendship. And we're going to be talking with John Cutterback, author of a brand new book on St. Thomas Aquinas, and we'll be excited to talk to him about the angelic doctor. And we'll also be talking today about potentially a future saint, somebody that I firmly believe will be recognized as one of the saints someday, and that is Venerable Al Schwartz. We're actually featuring him on an episode of They Might Be Saints on March 16th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN, so you'll want to tune in for that. But we'll be talking today with a biographer of his, and that is Kevin Wells. He wrote the book Priest and Beggar, which will be coming out from Ignatius Press. We'll be talking to him about the incredible life of heroic virtue of that future saint, Father Al Schwartz. And like we always do, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. And particularly today, we've got the icon of the Mother of God, Kosolshansk from Lubatsky, Ukraine, in the 16th century. And the Catholic Pub trivia question will be about St. Thomas Aquinas, so get your knowledge ready for that. And question of the week, we have a great one about visions of Mary, how they fit into the seven mansions of contemplative prayer. That was one of the better questions I've gotten in a long time, so I'll give my best to answer that one. And the might-be saint of the day for today, March 6th, we've got Blessed Sylvester of Assisi. We all know St. Francis of Assisi, but did you know that there are other saints from Assisi as well? So we'll be talking to you about Blessed Sylvester in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we try to pick some of the miracle stories that have been posted to the Miracle Hunter Facebook page. One interesting story that got some reaction from people was that this Mount Etna in Catania in Sicily has, you may have seen this in the news, it's recently been violently erupting. And the volcano is very near the sanctuary or apparition site of Our Lady of Belpasso, which is known, she's known as Madonna della Roccia, Our Lady of the Rock. And this is a church-approved location in the sense that the expression of devotion and faith is encouraged at this location. It has not been given the supernatural stance of the very famous apparitions like Fatima, Lourdes, or Guadalupe, but according to the stories anyway, in the reports, the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared 32 times to a 15-year-old young man, visionary Rosario Toscano, from May 11, 1986 to May 1st, 1988. And again, that is not a fully approved Marian apparition, but it's in those early stages where the church sees some value in it and there's nothing contrary to faith and morals. So they're actually promoting this as a place that you can express your faith in. And at Belpasso, at this Marian apparition site, the Immaculate Heart of the Queen of Peace is the title that Mary revealed herself, according to the story. And so we're looking for people to pray for the protection of Our Lady's shrine there in Belpasso, but also for, of course, the safety of the people there, the townspeople of Belpasso in Italy. In other miracle news, and additionally not exciting or fun miracle news, there's reports related to Venerable Cornelia Connolly, who is one of the very few Americans on the path to sainthood. And she was born in the United States, but buried in England. And so there had been some plans for her body to be brought to the United States so that canonization cause could move forward. And you probably are familiar with this sort of thing when we were talking about Fulton Sheen some time ago in this past year, prior to the pandemic. Fulton Sheen's body was in New York, but the people in Peoria were doing his cause for canonization. So in order for the beatification to take place, to move forward, they needed the body in the place where the beatification was going to be. So there was that huge debate, and the body was eventually moved to Peoria, and then they were going to do the beatification, and then it got postponed, and then coronavirus hit. So we're still waiting for Venerable Fulton Sheen to become a blessed. He's got the miracle and everything, but when we refer to Venerable Cornelia Connolly, we have a very similar situation. So the religious order, they announced on Thursday that it had withdrawn an application to exhume the body of its U.S.-born founder following an outcry in England where the nun is buried. So this was just a week ago. The Society of the Holy Child Jesus said that it had abandoned its plans to transfer part of the mortal remains of Venerable Cornelia Connolly to Philadelphia. And here's a quote. It says, "A decision has been made to withdraw the application to the Historic Churches Commission for the exhumation of Venerable Cornelia Connolly," statement said, and it was signed by various members of the society leadership team there. And Venerable Connolly, she was born in Philadelphia. She died in 1879 in the English town of St. Leonard-on-Sea, where she had founded a school. And she was the mother of five, a convert, and the founder of a religious congregation. She was buried there in the convent cemetery in Mayfield, East Sussex. But her body was moved in 1935 to the chapel of the Mayfield School, which she had built in 1872. So her order that she had founded hoped to transfer her remains to the Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul in Philadelphia. An announcement of the move was still visible on the cathedral's website on February 25th, but it was later removed. So they still had that plan to do that. And the sacred remains of the foundress of the Society of the Holy Child Jesus, Venerable Cornelia Connolly, it said, will soon be translated from England to the Basilica tomb, but that never happened, and it was supposed to be placed in the rear of the Basilica on the Ray Street side there in the cathedral here in the United States. So the proposal encountered fierce opposition, apparently, when the order applied to the South Historic Churches Committee for permission to extract her coffin before returning it through an opening made in the sidewall of this 14th century chapel. And the Tablet, you might be familiar with this British Catholic Weekly, it reported the previous week that the committee had received 120 objections to the plan, and a petition against the exhumation gained more than 1,400 supporters. So this was a big deal. And it says, quote, "We are saddened by any pain and upset this move causes. The society believes that by being in the cathedral alongside St. Catherine Drexel, another Philadelphia founder, Cornelia's life legacy and our charism will have the potential to be recognized, seen, and shared by a larger number of people, allowing a greater spotlight on her work and her cause for canonization." So so sort of sad news. It seems that that canonization cause will be put on hold again. And so we hope that someday that she will be declared a blessed and a saint. So we have another in the United States, and perhaps we'll be featuring her someday on They Might Be Saints on EWTN. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week. We ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that gets the right answer. Friends of mine who know me know that I love pub trivia, so in non-coronavirus times, you might find me in a bar answering pub trivia questions. But this is Catholic Pub Trivia, so we'll be asking you questions about our faith. And so last week, we had a great interview with Dan Cheeley, church historian, about some of the relics of the crucifixion. And if you missed that episode, I encourage you to tune in to the audio archive, which you can get if you go to the EWTN website, ewtn.com/radio, and search for Miracle Hunter, or you can go to the Facebook feed. We've got different links posted to that interview. But we talked about the different things, the crown of thorns, the nails, and then the titulus, which is the sign or the placard above the head of Jesus Christ. Now, it's often depicted in Latin with the letters I-N-R-I, Jesus Nazarene Rex Judaeorum, Jesus Christ, King of the Jews. Now, according to John 9, chapter 19, verse 20, this is the question, what other languages were written on it? And the answer was that it was written in three languages, Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. So thanks for those people who wrote in with that answer. So the answers were Hebrew and Greek in addition to Latin. Now, for this week's question, we're talking about the great philosopher Saint Thomas Aquinas on this show. And so he had all sorts of nicknames, the angelic doctor being one of them. But what was the less than flattering nickname that he gave himself? So the question again, regarding Thomas Aquinas, what was the less than flattering nickname that he gave himself? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, and we'll see if you've got the fastest answer, and the winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, But when we come back, we're going to be talking with John Cutterbeck, author of True Friendship. We'll be looking at the reflections of the great saint, St. Thomas Aquinas, on that big topic of friendship. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk a lot about saints on this program, and one of the great saints in the history of our Catholic Church is St. Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor, or the dumb ox, as he called himself. And March 7th is actually the feast day of St. Thomas Aquinas in some places, and that's tomorrow. So this is a great opportunity to talk about the angelic doctor. And there's a new book that's out that focuses on St. Thomas Aquinas' views on friendship. And the name of the book is True Friendship, Where Virtue Becomes Happiness. And the author is John Cutterbeck. And we welcome to the program a professor of philosophy from Christendom College, and that's Dr. John Cutterbeck. Welcome to the show today, John.
Thanks, Michael.
It's great to have you on. And I've always been interested in this concept of sort of the philosophical approach to friendship. I don't know if it was the Nicomachean Ethics with Aristotle or otherwise, but these, you know, different types of friendship that have been sort of looked at over the years, I think are pretty interesting. And we have St. Thomas Aquinas, maybe the greatest Christian mind in history, with some reflections on this. So in your book, True Friendship, you kind of draw from Thomas's look at friendship. What inspired you to put this book together?
Well, I'll tell you. What inspired me was seeing how these truths, these teachings, change lives. I've been teaching philosophy at Christendom College for 25 years, and from the start, my main interest was the good life, ethics. And there's so many different beautiful aspects of it that are life-changing, but one that particularly always stood out was in studying St. Thomas, which is also very much Aristotle's, though St. Thomas takes it further, and studying that understanding of friendship. It was such a light bulb moment. It was challenging and in certain ways difficult for people to hear, but also incredibly freeing. And it really, in so many fundamental ways, changed their approach to life. And I just knew I need to share this with more people. It's so at the center of existence.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Dr. John Cutterbeck about this new book, True Friendship. And I think that as a philosopher, you draw from different backgrounds on this. And St. Thomas Aquinas is one of the main people. And also St. Alured. I'm not as familiar with that name. Who is St. Alured?
You know, St. Alured was a Cistercian abbot in medieval England. And it's really funny. He stands out as there were other minor works on friendship, but this really is the premier medieval work, a book written simply on friendship. St. Thomas writes a bit on friendship. He didn't write any kind of separate treatises on friendship. And St. Albert's a little before St. Thomas, but their work fits together perfectly. And St. Alured is very explicitly connecting the insights of the ancients to the issue of spiritual friendship and the role of friendship in the Christian life. So I'm particularly interested in how, because this is very much, again, what's going on with St. Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle, is how St. Thomas takes what we learn from natural reason, what we learn kind of from natural human experience that even the ancients saw about, really, you could say, this most important of human relationships. Maybe marriage, of course, you know, is the most necessary to human life, but then again, marriage itself, to be what it can and should be, needs to be a friendship. So in any case, friendship is always at the center of human life.
Absolutely. And when we look at Aristotle, for example, he's got these different types of friendship he defines. For example, friendship of utility, where someone is useful to you in some way, therefore then you want to be their friend, or friendship of enjoyment, where you enjoy their company, actually, and friendships of the good, where they're based on mutual respect, admiration. In your book, True Friendship, what are the different types of friendship that you analyze in this book?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have rightly gone for the fundamental division into three. And That's a very helpful one, and it takes a little sorting out. It's not as straightforward as people sometimes think. When you look at what he calls friendship of pleasure and the friendship of utility, at first it can seem that these are, well, gosh, I mean, really, should we have, when you compare them to the third kind, virtuous friendship, good friendship, which you can also kind of call true or full friendship, it can make you think, gosh, you know, should I have these other two at all? But one of the main things I try to bring out is when the beautiful aspects of friendship is in God's great plan, there's different levels, there's different kinds that fit in different ways in our life. And so part of what we need to learn and then be intentional about is how to be cultivating different kinds of friendship, and remember that you can't go deep with everybody. So to have a friendship of pleasure, which is basically just we enjoy spending time together. We appreciate the same kinds of things in life, and so we, you know, it's often someone in the community that we don't get to spend a lot of time with, but when we do, we really enjoy being around. Friendship that can have kind of mix with this other kind. And these pure types aren't that it means you only absolutely would fit into one perfectly or the other. That can mix with a friendship of utility where, you know, we help one another out. I do this for you, you do this for me, and you know that's basically where the friendship is. It doesn't go much further than that. There's not necessarily anything crass or anything wrong with that, but it needs to be recognized for it is what it is. And with any number of people, realistically, we're not really able to go deeper. The big difference there is those are not really rooted in having to get to know the other person the way he is, and really in that then deeper knowledge to be drawn into a deeper kind of love, which always presupposes that there is a deeper knowledge. So just to sort out that you really can only go really more deeply with a few, and then to focus in on what that is, that's the main ultimate goal in the book.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Dr. John Cutterbeck, the professor of philosophy from Christendom College and author of the new book, True Friendship. In your book, you discuss sort of the moral and intellectual aspects of friendship and virtue. To the secular mind, perhaps, they might say, what does virtue have to do with anything? Why is that even in the conversation of friendship? Why is virtue an essential aspect of it?
Yeah, that's a great thing to bring up. One thing I think is really kind of a truth that's right at the heart of this whole situation is friendship, both understanding what it is and then even more importantly, its practice, have to be rooted in an understanding of what it is to be human. And at the center of a right understanding of what it is to be human, said from the viewpoint of natural reason, something Aristotle saw so powerfully, is that the virtuous life is the good life. I love to say this is foundational to all of life, to see this. Happiness is not so much a reward for living virtuously. Happiness is in living virtuously. This is what Aristotle saw. This fits so perfectly with Christianity. And so the way this transitions and connects to friendship is what at the end of the day is friendship most about, especially the deep kind here. It's about really knowing and loving the other person. What's loving the other person mean? It means wanting what's best for him. And if we want what's best for him, of course, we have to have some sense of what it is. We have to know what's best. And so it's rooted in the truth of human nature. And true love then means really wanting that other person to flourish in the true sense, which means to grow in virtue. In a Christian context, we especially say that means then growing in holiness also. So that's why it's so key to see this truth of what virtue is, what it means in human life, because then that is what friendship is most of all about. It's living a truly good life together, helping one another to do that. And that's the way God designed it, that we don't really achieve becoming who we are, achieve living a truly good life, except in and through working on that together with our friends.
Very well put. And when we look at the way, the different contexts of friendship, I really like the way you organize the book, because you talk about friendship and society, or dating, marriage, and friendship, or friendship with parents, teachers, and mentors, or our friendship with God and our neighbor. I thought that was a smart way to divide those things up. In your opinion, does one of those ways of friendship supersede the others?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because it is a matter of kind of seeing everything in its proper place. I mean, some of this varies depending on our state in life, depending on our age, depending on our vocation. There's certain things that are always going to be the same. And so going back to those three kinds, kind of the friendship of pleasure, friendship of utility, and then the true or virtuous friendship. I mean, for all of us, I'd say we need to recognize the importance of having peers, of having that person that fundamentally is kind of at my side, not someone here who's mentoring me, not someone so much whom I'm mentoring. You know, mentoring is a beautiful key relationship that I love to then address of how they're in. How can you have a special kind of friendship there? If you say one kind of takes priority, say we, in as much as friendship is most of all about kind of being right there together and sharing as much as possible. This is where the ancients have the great insight of you know, like attracts like. Friends have the same fundamental convictions and likes and dislikes. And so there's a kind of primacy, particularly again as we come into adulthood, of recognizing, you know, we need to be, whoever we are, developing those really deep peer relationships, kind of partners in life here. But there's this great diversity, right? If we're called to be married, then the main person we're seeking true friendship with, and of this fullest form of the peer, is going to be our spouse. And then that itself calls for other relationships that kind of fit with that.
We're talking today with Dr. John Cuddeback, the professor of philosophy from Christendom College and author of the new book, True Friendship, which focuses on the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. And I think in the Old and New Testament, there's a sort of a premium or a highlight placed on friendship. In our Christian vision, philosophers' insights give us a broader supernatural perspective. And we talk a lot about the supernatural on this show. What would the supernatural aspect of friendship be that we are trying to attain here?
Yeah, well, it kind of brings us right to a key point. I'm going to go to something from St. Alred. A very beautiful point from St. Alred is friendship is at the heart of God's plan. And what is ultimately God's plan? God has designed us, he has created us and called us to friendship with himself. So he's preparing us for that throughout our life. And so I so love to think in terms of Albert saying God's always been at work. Even relationships that didn't go the way that they could have and should have, you know, our loving and providential God has been at work preparing us, bringing us along through good times and bad, preparing us for relationship with him. And so the importance of friendship takes on a whole new meaning here in the supernatural context. When you look at the 15th chapter of the Gospel of St. John, I have called you friend. And that our Lord is saying that to all of us, it is just absolutely earth-shattering. I mean, in so many ways, we're used to it. I love to point out, you know, Aristotle, the great master of friendship, using the light of natural reason, asks, can you be friends with God? And his answer to that is basically no. And it's a very reasonable answer. Why? Because you can't share one life with him. You can't move on the same plane at all with God. So how could you possibly call yourself a friend? So it's so beautiful then when you know, St. Thomas comes along to be able to kind of bring this particularly to light for us, saying, was Aristotle just making a big mistake there? No, in principle, he was right. But God has done something that Aristotle couldn't possibly have imagined. Namely, he's reached down to us, and this is the heart of understanding the incarnation. He's come close to us. Friendship is always about coming close. So he's come close to us, and he's saying, I am inviting you to share my life. I mean, now we are moving at the supernatural level. And here now, just to not talk about something that is really downright miraculous. St. Alred talks about how friendship is very difficult any way you slice it. And any way you slice it, the ancients talked about how this real, deeper kind of friendship is rare. It doesn't happen that often because it's so difficult. So St. Alred points out, hey, and now, you know, we have this supernatural aspect, this deeper friendship, and being actually called to friendship with God. I mean, how can we do such a thing? He said, thank God that the Lord himself said to us, ask and you shall receive. This is something we have to pray for. We have to pray, even just to really have that flourishing human friendship. We pray for it because it's such an unfathomable gift. It's not something that we could fully achieve ourselves. And so it calls for grace, but it's a grace that God wants to give us. And it's beyond what we ever could have imagined.
Absolutely. And as we wrap up the show today, one reflection that I had is St. Thomas Aquinas had this vision. He had this heavenly vision on December 6th of 1273, and he was told to take up his pen again in this vision. But the quote that he said, "These things have been revealed to me, and all that I've written seems to be much as straw. And now I wait for the end of my life." So he, in humility, he sees where his writing rates when we have a divine perspective. But we don't view his writing as straw. And so, where is his commentary on friendship? How does it rank compared to all the other things? He doesn't have his own treatise on this, as you mentioned. But how important is his reflections on friendship throughout his writings?
It's super important. But you do have to kind of peek around to find it. And that's one reason I really wanted to write this book. It's because most people, it's not so easy for them to kind of get in there and make their way around. But it's in his commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, which is Aristotle's great ethical work. Two of the 10 books or chapters of the Nicomachean Ethics are on friendship, 8 and 9 out of the 10. And so St. Thomas has a very extensive commentary there, and in the Summa in various places in the first part. The second part was just he's starting moral theology. He'll say, is friendship necessary in human life? And, you know, have some great articles there. One of the things I particularly love is how he then uses the notion of friendship to explain what supernatural charity is. If you go in the Summa to his treatise on charity, the highest of virtues, for him to say what supernatural charity is, he says it fundamentally is friendship, true friendship between God and the soul. And so, I mean, talk about it being thematic. And that's kind of where my book culminates is in seeing, boy, all the things that we learn about friendship from the philosophical viewpoint, they all come home to roost in this incredibly beautiful way of seeing all those same things, that the concrete things we learn in human friendship, how to have good conversation, how friendship is lived in sharing our souls in conversation. Well, we establish those habits there, and that's exactly what's at the heart of our relationship with God, too, supernaturally. St. Thomas says that you can call the spiritual life a conversation between the soul and God. So he is constantly using these notions of friendship right there at the heights of what God's calling us to.
Amazing. And we've been talking today with John Cuddeback about his new book, True Friendship, Where Virtue Becomes Happiness, and that's from Ignatius Press. You can go to ignatius.org, or you can check out John's website, his blog at life-craft.org for more information on him. Well, thank you so much, Dr. John Cuddeback, for joining us on today's program.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
God bless. That was Dr. John Cuddeback. Great new book called True Friendship and some interesting reflections on St. Thomas Aquinas. This was a great time to talk about the angelic doctor and his views on friendship. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions relating to miracles and those things that might be miracles. And I've done a couple of virtual presentations in this past week, and I've even answered a few questions on those presentations, and we're going to be repeating a few of those in the weeks ahead because the questions were so good. So if people are interested in having me give a virtual presentation, send me an email. Go through the Miracle Hunter website, and perhaps we'll answer the questions of your parish or your group coming up soon. And so the question this week, it was, last night, Michael O'Neill gave a fantastic virtual presentation to our parish, St. Margaret's in Madison, Connecticut, full of great information and suspense. The question was, how do visions of Mary fit into the seven mansions of contemplative prayer? Thank you, Chris. So that was Chris writing in. He was one of the attendees of that virtual presentation, and that was a great question. One of the tougher questions I've gotten in recent times, anyway. And so I think that when we talk about the mystical mansions, the seven mansions of contemplative prayer, if we had to assign one for the visions of Mary, and it's a tough question because the mansions of contemplative prayer sort of imply that you've progressed from the first one to the seventh one, and that you're getting more holy and more connected to God as each step goes up. So the question is, do visions of Mary fit into any of the seven mansions of contemplative prayer? But if you had to pick one, extraordinary mystical phenomena, at least according to St. Teresa of Avila, they belong to the sixth mansion. But I kind of hesitate to answer the question that way because there's such a variety in the types of people who receive visions and the places in their own faith journey or their spiritual life. So, we even have cases like Alphonse Ratisbonne, who in Rome in the 1800s, he was an atheist. And we have other people who aren't even Christian. And then we have, people who are, they have reached that seventh mansion of contemplative prayer. And then there are young children who don't know what a mansion or a contemplative prayer is in the first place. So there's a huge variety in the type of people who have received visions of Mary. So I would like to say that that Mary meets us where we are in the sense of that, there's not a certain level you achieve in order to receive those visions. And only a few visionaries have been saints. They're the famous ones, of course, the Shepherd Children of Fatima, or St. Bernadette Subaru, or St. Margaret Mary Alacoque, these very famous saints, perhaps they were at that level. But in general, we're talking about people who are not quite there. So it seems that Mary appears to people along that entire spectrum in the faith journey. So thank you, Chris, for that answer, or for that question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, and maybe we'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion that lines up exactly to the day's date. We all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion that lines up to each and every day of the calendar year. And so for today's date, we've got the icon of the Mother of God, Kozenshchansk, from Kobylaski in the Ukraine in the 16th century. And this Italian Marian icon was brought to Russia in the 18th century by an Italian attendant to the Empress Elizabeth. The lady and her icon went to the Ukraine after she married an army clerk. The icon's feast on March 6th, or February 21st in the old calendar, commemorates the healing in 1881 of Maria, the daughter of Count Vladimir Klapnicht, who then owned the icon. After time spent cleaning the icon and in prayer, Maria's mysterious crippling illness disappeared. With a growing renown for miracles, the icon was moved to a chapel built for it in Kozelshchansk, and later enlarged to a church with a convent. After some time in hiding, the icon returned in 1993 to the Nativity of the Mother of God Church. And that's the icon of the Mother of God, Kozelshchansk, from Kolylaski in Ukraine from the 16th century. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the other Marian devotions from around the world, connect to the website 365dayswithmary.com, pick up the book, download the app, or join the Facebook feed with 10,000 followers of 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at the sainthood news. We do this every week where we kind of connect to the project They Might Be Saints, which is the television series that's airing on EWTN. Now it airs weekly. This is a great thing on Mondays at 10:30, or I should say 11:30 Eastern Time AM, and that's on Monday, and then on Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern Time. That's when the program airs. And when new episodes come out, like the Father Al Schwartz episode, that'll be coming out on March 16th at 5:30 p.m. So be sure to stay tuned for that. So we like to talk about the sainthood news, which saints are in the pipeline, so to speak. So recently, Pope Francis recognized the heroic virtue of Father Albino Alves de Cunha e Silva, a 20th century Portuguese priest who is also recognized to have lived a life of heroic virtue. Now, a few years after Silva was ordained a priest, the 1910 revolution broke out in Portugal, and the anti-clericalist provisional government took power, and they expelled the Jesuits and other religious priests, and they closed the convents, they forbade religious teaching in schools, and they institutionalized legal divorce. But Silva, he refused to submit, and he was arrested. But before he could be exiled to Africa, he escaped, and then was smuggled into Spain, eventually being put on a boat for Brazil. And there he served as a parish priest for Cantanduva, where he was not treated with welcome, at least at the beginning. But eventually, he won over the hearts and trust of the community, and he built a new church and a hospital and a home home for the elderly. He also founded schools of higher education, a facility for medicine to train up doctors to work in this hospital. And in the very end years of his life, he was in poor health. Silva, he resided at the hospital, personally helping with patients and other tasks. He died in 1973, 2 days before his 91st birthday. And so that is the new venerable that Pope Francis has just recently recognized. Now let's take a look at the might-be saint of the day. And so we talk about these people who might be saints, of miracle workers to martyrs, to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue. These are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And so for today, March 6th, we've got Blessed Sylvester of Assisi. Now, he was born to nobility, and he was one of the first 12 followers of St. Francis of Assisi and the very first priest in the Franciscan order. And Sylvester once sold Francis a stone to build a church, and a short while later, he saw Francis and Bernard distributing Bernard's wealth to the poor, and Sylvester complained that he only had been poorly paid for the stone, and he asked for more money. Francis obliged, but the handful of money soon filled Sylvester with guilt. So he sold his possessions, began a life of penance, and joined Francis's community. And he was later considered a holy and prayerful man, traveling everywhere with Francis, and he became actually the advisor to Francis. And it was Sylvester and Claire who answered Francis's question with the response that he should serve God by going out to preach rather than devoting himself to prayer. In a city involved in a civil war, Francis ordered Sylvester to drive the devils out. At the city gate, Sylvester cried out, "In the name of Almighty God, and by virtue of the command of his servant Francis, depart from here, all you evil spirits," end quote. And peace returned to the city. And Blessed Sylvester of Assisi, he died in the year 1240, and he's buried in the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi, Italy. And he still needs a miracle in order to advance to sainthood. And that's the Might Be Saint of the Day. That's Blessed Sylvester of Assisi. For more information on They Might Be Saints, the program that airs on EWTN weekly now, Mondays at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, you connect to the page theymightbesaints.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with author Kevin Wells about his book, Priest and Beggar, about the heroic life of Venerable Father Al Schwartz, who will be the subject of an episode of They Might Be Saints coming up on March 16th. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter. On EWTN, here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People know the show, They Might Be Saints, which airs on EWTN Weekly now. You can catch it on Mondays at 11:30 Eastern Time in the morning, or on Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's been an exciting journey filming the lives of these Americans on the path to sainthood, future saints, you might say. When I've gone and traveled to these various places around the United States and met the people who promote the causes, it's really an inspiring thing. And 2 years ago or so, I was in Chalco, Mexico, which is a very poor area in near Mexico City, out on the outskirts of Mexico City. And I had the privilege of witnessing the work of a priest from Washington, D.C. His name was Father Aloysius Schwartz, and he is the subject of our next episode coming up on They Might Be Saints on March 16th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The work that this priest did, dedicating his life to the service of the poor children of the world, is absolutely amazing. And I'm not much of a emotional person myself, but it brought me to tears, literally, when I came back to the United States and told people about it, because this was such an amazing thing to see how he lifted these people from their situation and brought the faith to them. We're so excited today to talk with an author who's got a great new book coming out. The name of the book is Priest and Beggar, The Heroic Life of Venerable Al Schwartz, and that's Kevin Wells. Welcome back to the show today, Kevin.
Michael, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited that you're putting together this book, and I know it's coming out from Ignatius Press down the road a little bit. May 20th will be the official launch date, and I'm sure people can buy early release copies if you go to, or at least reserve a copy if you go to Amazon or Ignatius Press. But we're excited about this book because it tells the story of an incredible man, and I'm always looking for miracles. That's what I do for a living. But going to Mexico and going to Chalco, that very poor area where he set up Girls Town, this Father Al did, and it really was perhaps the greatest miracle I've seen with my own two eyes. And so I'm excited to talk to you today about, I know you wrote a book, The Priests We Need. We've talked about that on the radio show before, but tell us a little bit, what got you interested in the life of Venerable Al Schwartz?
Well, Michael, it's interesting. In 2019, Sophia released a book I had written, The Priests We Need to Save the Church. I guess it got pretty wide readership. And one of the readers came up to me one night and he said, Kevin, I know who the priest we need is. His name is Al Schwartz, and I want you to write his biography. And, you know, I scratched my head. I've heard of him, but I really didn't know much about him. So he gave me a couple books, and I read them. And Michael, I'll tell you, you know, to prepare for the Priest We Need book, I had read the biographies of Philip Neri, John Vianney, Maximilian Kolbe, Damien the Leper, Vincent de Paul, did a lot of research on some of the greatest precincts. And what I had seen or what I had read in the life of Venerable Aloysius Schwartz was unlike anything I had encountered in these great biographies of these precincts. It was incomprehensible. You saw it and cried. And when I went down, Michael, I cried too. What he did, and as the miracle hunter, what he did, I think, can only be described as of God. It was miraculous.
Absolutely. So let's sort of paint the picture for people so people know who this man is. So Father Al Schwartz is a priest from Washington, D.C., and tell the story of how does he decide to take on a missionary life?
It's great. Well, so Father Al grew up in the teeth of the Depression. He was born in 1930, right in the heart of the Depression. He had learned early on, he had seen up close poverty. His family was very poor. He rose above it and was drawn closer to God in this poverty. I don't know why, but he was. He wanted to become a priest at an early age. So what had happened, Michael, is he went to Minor Seminary in Baltimore. And as a 14-year-old, a Mary Knoll missionary named Father Charles Byrne came to Father Patrick Byrne came to his seminary and essentially told a room full of young seminarians, consider becoming a martyr in the Far East where I am. I'm in Japan. The bombs were just dropped. They're looking for something new. They want to become Catholic. And you, seminarians, you have the power in your hands to bring them the healing balm of the Catholic faith. Come with me. Become a martyr for Christ. And that day, he was resolved to sort of become Jesus Christ crucified as a missionary. And the tone was set. He said, I want to go to some of the poorest places in the world to serve Christ.
Yeah, and so where did he go? I mean, I think that his impact, you know, I was just in Mexico and I saw his Girls Town, but he set up homes in other places as well, the Philippines, Korea. Talk about sort of the global reach that his work has had.
Sure. So what happened was he ended up in Belgium at a seminary in Belgium. And as a 27-year-old, he told his formator, I want to go to the, it's literally the worst place in the world. And the formator said, well, the Korean War just ended. He said, send me there. So he ended up going to Korea, and he got off the train that took him from Seoul to the Southern Peninsula, and he saw orphans everywhere in the streets. He saw the tubercular. He saw lepers. He saw homeless beggars. And he said, I need to save them. I need to do this because I told Mary, essentially, he gave his priesthood over to Mary, that I would. And he went from Korea, then he went to the Philippines. And Michael, as you know, in his dying days when he was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, he said, you know what? I think Mary is calling me to Mexico. So as he was suffering from ALS, he took off from Mexico and started his mission there.
Absolutely. And I think that going to Mexico and seeing what I saw, it was amazing. And I think that somebody described it to me as we were approaching Chalco. And it was one of these things where when we were driving up in the bus, we were going through what I would describe as the worst, most dangerous-looking area I've ever been through in my entire life. And these steel gates open, and then, you know, sort of a paradise is behind the doors. And we're greeted by these girls who've been pulled off the streets, perhaps, in Mexico. And they described them as girls who had never used a fork and knife, who had never used a toilet, who had never slept in a bed. And these girls go on to, you know, enter either religious life or become doctors. doctors and lawyers and engineers and the whole thing, big members of society who brought their communities up with them and their families as well. So it was amazing to see these young women, and it was really eye-opening. I think that one of the things that really drew my attention is when we went to Mass, and they celebrated the Mass, and they did a Eucharistic procession. And each one of those girls, to my eye, they were locked on to that Eucharistic host being processed through the aisle, and they were each so reverent, and it was just an amazing thing for me to see. And I just never thought I'd see anything like that ever again. So the fact that Father Al has spread this far and wide all over the world is amazing. How many children are the estimates at these days as far as people who have gone through his programs?
Sure. Well, today, this very day, there's 21,000 children in 17 different locations in Africa, in the Far East, and over here in the West, in Central and South America. Over 170 graduates have gone through these Boys Towns and Girls Towns. It's fully accredited 5-year high school education. And Michael, I'll tell you what impacts me the most is not only is he taking these children who grew up orphans, who plowed fields barefoot at the age of 8 or 9 with no food when they got home at night. I mean, devastated lives, the poorest of the poor. But what these Sisters of Mary do, the order that Father Al founded, there's over 400 sisters in this order that take care of these children and educate them. What they do after 5 years is not only, as you mentioned, Michael, do they send them out as doctors and nurses and priests and sisters, but they send them out as witnesses, as sort of missionaries to the world. They're sort of like born-again Lazaruses that go into the world as Catholic missionaries.
We're talking today with Kevin Wells, author of Priest and Beggar, The Heroic Life of Venerable Al Schwartz. That'll be out from Ignatius Press on May 20th. And we're talking ahead of the They Might Be Saints episode related to Father Al Schwartz. That'll be airing March 16th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We encourage people to tune in to find out about the life of this incredible priest. And when you reflect back on the life of Father Al, how did he do this? I mean, it's miraculous in so many ways. The hand of God guided this or touched this, or but how did he actually make this happen in such a big way?
Well, I think it's two steps. Well, when he was in seminary, he went to the obscure apparition site of Banneaux, where he sort of fell in love with the Virgin of the Poor, Our Lady of Banneaux. But for the first time in the history of apparitions, she revealed herself as Our Lady of the Poor. So he sort of said, I am determined, Mary, to feed the poor all over the world. I will not take a day off for the remainder of my priesthood. I will become your slave to the poor. So once he determined to do that, literally millions of dollars started to come in when he said this. Okay, I have hundreds of thousands of the dying in Korea. How do I get the money? So he had an idea. He said, there's this fancy stitch, this embroidery, this stitch that the Koreans make that no one else makes. So he had these handkerchiefs, and he hired 3,000 poor women in Korea and said, I want you to put on this handkerchief, sort of whimsical scenes of kids walking through a playground or on a seesaw or maybe a girl fetching water from a well. I'm going to send them to America with a couple pictures of the poverty of Korea. And within 6 months, millions of dollars started to come in. And within about 10 years, he was receiving tens of millions of dollars. Roger Staubach, Jimmy Stewart, Bing Crosby, Hollywood stars started to say, boy, this priest is a hero. And after that, it just started to roll more. And before long, really hundreds of millions of dollars, literally, started to come in, and he had the largest nonprofit in the world. And get this, Michael, you may know this, because he didn't want any scandal to come his way, he said, I'm going to live in a shack with no plumbing and no electricity, nothing, because I don't want any form of impropriety or anyone to think that I might be using the money. I just need to be with God, because God's going to tell me how to handle this money.
Yeah, it's an absolutely amazing story. We're talking today about Father Al Schwartz. He's the subject of the book Priest and Beggar, The Heroic Life of Venerable Al Schwartz, written by Kevin Wells, whom we're talking with today. That'll be out on May 20th. And, of course, on They Might Be Saints, March 16th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, we'll be airing an episode on EWTN all about this incredible priest. And When you learned about the life of Father Al Schwartz, I'm going to ask you sort of a personal question here. How did it affect your life of faith when you encountered, you said you studied all these incredible priests for the book, The Priest We Need, but how did that affect you personally other than wanting to write about him?
I think that's a great question. It's a simple answer. Too much comfort is dangerous for me, whether it's grabbing a bag of chips when I don't want it, or whether it's sleeping in an extra hour or not obliging those duties that my family demands of me, you know, hugging my wife, playing catch the baseball with my son, playing Monopoly with my daughter when I don't feel like it. It's when I sort of die to myself, as Father Al showed me, when I become sort of the slaughtered lamb and just give of myself, as Father Al gave to Mary in his slavery and his servitude to her. It's when it's kind of the acronym FAMILY, FAMILY. Forget about me, I love you. In my own little sort of spectrum as a dad and a husband and as a neighbor and as an employee, it's when I sacrifice the most, is that I guess I look most like Christ on the cross and like Father Al.
Yeah, and I think what's great about Father Al, and I feel the same way as you do, I think he's such an inspiration for our own personal lives. And I think that when we look at Father Al's life, we talk about his future sainthood, because I think that I think even Tom and Glory Sullivan, who are benefactors to some of the great works of Father Al in Chalco and otherwise, I think they tell the story in the documentary that will be airing on March 16th at 5:30 p.m. On EWTN. They say when Father Al visited their home and after they left, they looked at each other and looked in their eyes and said, "We have met a saint." And he's now a venerable, which means he's along the path to sainthood, moving from servant of God to venerable. His life of heroic virtue has been validated. What needs to happen next in order for Father Al to be declared a saint?
Well, I think it's what you know so well, Michael. There needs to be a few miracles that are attributed to him to move things along. And also, I think because Father Al prayed not to be known, he thought in a certain way if his work was known that it would become tainted. So I kind of broke the seal with a biography, and Michael, you have too with the documentary. He's known now, and we need people to pray. There's a beatification prayer that can be found on worldvillages.org to pray for his beatification. And if you're ill and you're sick and you need a miracle, pray for Father Al. The sisters have told me, and maybe, Michael, they've told you the same, that already more than two dozen folks claim that they've been healed because of prayer to Father Al. It hasn't been studied and documented by the Vatican just because they haven't decided to go that way. But we're at the point now, once when people really understand the power and the magnitude of his priesthood, I think as far as someone who is an intercessor, I don't know who you would want to go to more than Father Al. And plus, we don't have a patron saint of Lou Gehrig disease, of ALS, which Father Al died from.
That's a great point. And so they're seeking miracles, and people can actually see the intercessory prayer at the end of the special. The They Might Be Saints program will be flashing that up as well. But check out the World Villages website as well. So we're so grateful to you, Kevin Wells, author of the new book, Priest and Beggar, The Heroic Life of Venerable Al Schwartz, coming out from Ignatius Press on May 20th. And also, we encourage people to tune in to the program on They Might Be Saints about Father Aloysius Schwartz on March 16th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, only here on EWTN. So thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you very much, Michael.
God bless. And that was Kevin Wells, author of Priest and Beggar. Check that book out when it becomes available, and be sure to tune in on March 16th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time for They Might Be Saints, where we're going to be telling the story of this incredible priest who you're not going to forget, and his name is Father Aloysius Schwartz. And that's all the time we have for today's program. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, search for Miracle Hunter, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank my guest, John Cuddeback, author of True Friendship, for that great discussion about St. Thomas Aquinas, and Kevin Wells, author of Priest and Beggar. Of course, that book is coming out May 20th from Ignatius Press, but we're looking at March 16th at 5:30 p.m. for the premiere of the new episode of They Might Be Saints, featuring the story of Father Al. And on October 18th through 27th, I'll be going on pilgrimage to see the Marian shrines of France, including Pontmain, which is celebrating in 2021 the 150th anniversary of those highly approved Marian apparitions there, and La Salette, which is in 2021 celebrating the 175th anniversary of the apparitions there. And of course, we'll be going to Lourdes and Paris and Lisieux to see all the places of France. So check it out, nativitypilgrimage.com/miraclehunter. And sign up for the newsletter on miraclehunter.com for more information on miracle stories, where I'll be speaking next, upcoming book releases, and more. We'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.